You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
I'm Strobe Talbot, and it is my great honor and pleasure to welcome all of you, and I'm going to turn over my shoulder and say all of our friends in Istanbul to the 9th annual Savanji Lecture. This is going to be an interactive conversation brought to us by the wonders of technology. Now, over the last 8 years, I have learned always to append to this statement the word inshallah, because I know that the first time I fail to say that, the screen is going to go blank, and it won't be quite as interactive as we would hope. So, inshallah, but we have great confidence in our technological colleagues. I want to, of course, welcome all of you who are here in the Falk Auditorium at the Brookings Institution, and also to pass my greetings and thanks to our friends on the other side of the video bridge at Sabancı University in Istanbul, and in particular to a personal friend, a friend of this institution, and to so many of us on both sides of this transaction today, and that's Güler Sabancı, who has made this nearly decade-old tradition possible, and I would say an ongoing success. She is, as I think everybody knows, the chair of the board of Sabancı University. She is the niece of the late Sagip Sabancı, who was a shrewd entrepreneur, a champion of Turkey's economic and democratic reforms, and a philanthropist to whom this lecture is a living memorial. Special greetings as well to his daughter, Dilek Sabancı, and also to Professor Isaac Atias, who will be moderating the conversation on the Istanbul side. Here at Brookings, I want to say how terrific it is to have Nihat Berker with us once again on this side of the bridge. He's occasionally been on the screen, but it's here wonderful to have him here today. And, of course, Fuat Kaman, who is the director of the Istanbul Policy Center, and has already contributed to the conversations that have been going on here in Washington over the last 24 hours. And Timur Bey, if I may say so, Timur Soylemes, who is the chargé of the Turkish Embassy here in Washington, has made his own contribution to these proceedings. And thank you for being with us this morning, or this afternoon, in the case of our friends on the other side. A word of gratitude to the 2013 Sabancı lecturer, Kaushik Basu, who is the chief economist of the World Bank and also formerly the chief economic advisor to the government of India. Kaushik is a renowned academic, an expert on development strategies, and emerging markets. And this is definitely the year for us to be discussing that topic. As we all know, this is the era of globalization, which by definition is an era in which geopolitics is now often driven by geoeconomics. The emerging economies have grown faster in their GDPs, to the tune of about three times faster over the last quarter of a century than the developed world. And prime examples of that phenomenon are, of course, Turkey and Dr. Basu's native land, India. In the 1960s, both of those countries had what were essentially closed economies. Since then, however, they have become both beneficiaries of and contributors to the very process of globalization. Both have produced global companies, a prime example of which is the Sabancı Group. another point about the nexus between geoeconomics and geopolitics. Turkey and India are members now of what might be called the Board of Directors of the World by virtue of the G20 and other forums to which they belong. They are also both playing constructive roles in their own neighborhoods. And of both, it can be said, they have zero neighbors with no problems. I suspect that will be part of the context of what we hear from Dr. Basu, including in his conversation with all of you, which will be moderated in Istanbul by Professor Atias and here in the Brookings Institution by my colleague Kamal Qureshi, our TUSIAD Senior Fellow and Director of our Turkey Project. Now, usually at this point in my ceremonial duties, I ask everybody to turn off their mobiles. I'm not going to do that today. I'm simply going to ask that you put your mobiles on silent, but that you use them if it's for purposes of tweeting. The Twitter handle, or hashtag, I guess it's called, to participate in the Twitterverse in this conversation and to make sure that as much of the world knows about it as possible is hashtag Sabanji13. Not quite sure why 13, but never mind. But keep that number in mind. Lucky 13, Sabanji13. And with that, I'm now going to turn the proceedings over to Güler Hanım.
Good morning, Washington, and thank you, Strop. Before going into the lecture, which we all look forward to, Dr. Tafishlik Basu's comments and lecture and discussion on that, I would like to take this opportunity for those who have contributed for this successful, the 9th anniversary of the Sakıp Sabancı lecture. I do feel really privileged and proud that both institutions, Brookings Institution and Sabancı University, has accomplished a partnership, I can say, through under the Strop Talbot, my friend's leadership. Kemal Derviş is there, and Dr. Kirişçi has joined them. And from our side, Fuat Keyman and Professor Nihat Berker, who is this year in Washington, and I'm here in Istanbul. But I'm also very proud and honored that this relationship, this partnership, successfully achieved its 9th year. As for those of you who all know my late uncle, Sakıp Sabancı, this lecture is in the honor of his memory and of his lifelong accomplishments. We try to honor his and cherish his legacy through his lecture and through connecting two worlds, Washington and Istanbul, through Brookings Institution and Sabancı University. And that would be, he would love to hear and see this. And I'm sure he's feeling this. He was a man who have understood that without morals, without ethics, without genuine commitment to the well-being of the community and the society at large, no enterprise could possibly succeed and no growth would be long-term and sustainable. He strongly believed in this. And as Sabancı family, we hold these values true to our hearts. And today, I'm very pleased to hear that we will be hearing from Kaşık Basu, who has been, Dr. Basu has been the champion, as Strop Talbot has just introduced us. He has been the champion of these values, who committed himself to the prosperity of the world community. So I'm looking forward of this lecture and the discussion afterwards. And thank you again for those of you who come and who join us and looking forward for this lecture. Thank you.
Mr. Strobe Talbot, Guler Sabanji, distinguished members of the Brookings fraternity over here, and also students, faculty, friends in Istanbul, Sabanji University. I had been to Sabanji years ago, but curiously enough, only for a meal. There was a small conference dinner that was organized, but it is now good for me to be able to interact long distance with you all. Let me stress that for me, this is a great honor to be delivering the Saqib Sabanji lecture. There are some industrialists who, through their, of course, enterprise that you need to be a successful industrialist, but moral courage, convictions can play a role in steering a nation. Saqib Sabanji was a person of great stature, played a major role along those lines. There have been similar characters in the country where we stand. I can think of my country, India. There are similar characters who have played a major role. And once again, thank you very much for Kamal, from whom I first got the invitation, Kamal Darwish, for the invitation to give this lecture. Thank you very much. We live in interesting times. As Strobe and I were walking in, he was saying, are the burdens of living in interesting times, which is true, that these are risky times. News can pause in at a pace that is alarming. News which is occasionally and up and off late, more frequently news of downs, keep pouring in. What's happening, and that's where I want to pitch my lecture, is about the changing structure and nature of the social world. What's happened over, I would say, the last 50 years is perhaps the most dramatic change in the social world. Social I use broadly to include economics, politics, and society, than maybe ever before. In particular, economic globalization has gone on almost hand in hand with politics and decision-making remaining balkanized and fragmented. This strange combination of balkanized politics and globalized economics has given rise to tensions, challenges of a kind that we have not seen before. About the globalization, economic globalization, I find the debate on whether it is good or bad pretty futile, because it's similar to debating whether gravity is good or bad. You can tear your hair over whether gravity is good or bad, but there isn't very much you can do about that. Globalization is something similar. No one individually plans to have globalization. It is millions and billions of individuals taking their own little decisions, new technologies sprouting up that has led to globalization. It's a part of life that we have to live with. We can do something about decision-making, which is fragmented, policy-making, which is fragmented. And that's where I'm going to focus the lecture, about the policy challenges. And in doing so, I'm going to use a combination of my own background, from completely academic economics to being plunged 4 years ago into the thick and turmoil of Indian policy-making, and now in the World Bank, of a concern with the developing countries all around, developing countries, emerging economies all around the world. And I've been arguing in the World Bank that we also ought to be engaged with the industrialized countries, simply because the world cannot be thought of along the partitioned lines that we once did. When I went to India first, to begin on a personal note, when you have discussions at the level of the policymakers, the top bureaucrats sitting in New Delhi, it'll be the same in Istanbul, where I've been several times in many different fora. It feels like as if you're in Washington or London or anywhere else. It's the same language being talked about. The people have broadly been educated in the same places. And really, there is very little to distinguish. And I've just been traveling in Africa, in Senegal and South Africa. And once again, it's a similar feeling that when you sit with the elites, it's the same newspapers being read, the same journals being read, so the language and everything seems similar. So what is different in a developing country, in an emerging economy? economy from an industrialized country. For me, there was the occasional reminder, dramatic reminder, that I was in a totally different setting, completely trivial, and I have written about this already, but it sort of stands out in my psyche. Is in Delhi, I had once a pest control problem in my home. So called in a pest control agency, a man came, Tamil gentleman with lots of cans and syringes, all kinds of chemicals, and started spraying my home. And he was working very hard, so I came in and said that, you know, you're working very hard, but will you get rid of the termite and pests? He said with a grin, sir, have no worries whatsoever. These chemicals are very strong stuff. They are totally banned in the United States. You know, by the time he was finishing his sentence, I was beginning to edge out of the room. So for him, what was a source of comfort, in many places it would be a source of great discomfort. But years have passed, nothing dreadful happened. So I'm taking that his lack of caution was fine. But small reminders like that would come every now and then, that we live in a very, very different economy. I would, for instance, when doing my Indian job, this could happen anywhere, this could happen in the US, people's understanding of the economy, who does what, is still very, very rudimentary. I would occasionally get a phone call from an aunt in Calcutta saying that prices have gone up once again. What is it that you're doing? So they would go to a market and find that the fish price has gone up. And there's the presumption that somehow sitting in Delhi, you can manage it all. So that fretting, which actually you see here as if a few people are managing this and causing this, is there everywhere. Which makes it important to bring a lot of professional knowledge into the management of the economy. This does create difficulties, I should tell you, a difficulty and an element of suspicion, which you see in the US, which you will see in Turkey, which I saw in India, that for a lot of people, it is not possible to understand the intricacies of policymaking. And you do worry at times that is policymaking being hijacked by a small group in their own interest? And that's not impossible. When a small group has specialized knowledge, it is possible. But the best guard against that is general education. People have to understand as well as possible some of the intricacies of policymaking so that ordinary human beings can be watchdogs about what is happening, what decision is being taken. I'm going to begin by giving you a very quick glimpse of the changing structure of the global economy and then go into some policy challenges. Let me give you one chart which I've been using, which is the BRICS economy. Do you have the... Okay, I'm going to do it. Yeah. So you will see over here the GDP proportion, fraction of the world GDP, which is the BRICS countries' GDP. Okay, that's all right. And they are okay in Sabanji, they are doing fine. They are seeing the same chart, I'm assuming, right? Yeah, hopefully. Okay, if you're not seeing the same chart, well, there are just two or three. You can think of something else while I get back to again to talking. You will see this is quite a dramatic chart. So I took the case of BRICS because BRICS countries are being tracked. That from somewhere like 15% of global GDP, 15-16% in 1990, the BRICS constitute today little over 26%, 27% of global GDP. We are talking of percent. So the share of the 100, a rise of this kind is rarely seen. So the emerging economies, you are seeing a very, very dramatic rise. Turkey over the last 10 years, I know, has been growing at just short of 5%, 4.7% or so, which for a country which is reasonably well off, I mean, $10,000 per capita income, a growth of 4.7, 4.8% sustained over a 10-year period is remarkable performance. Indeed, I remember sitting in India. Of course, I would be watching the industrialized countries all the time because it mattered a lot what was happening in Europe, what was happening in the US. But I was also, we were watching Turkey a lot because I have to say that to the credit of the Turkish policymakers, particularly the central bank, they've been very creative or experimental. This is a word one usually uses with some caution about a central bank. Central banks are meant to be very traditional, but I do this with some appreciation that the Turkish Central Bank has brought in some innovative ideas, made moves that were controversial, but they were sort of testing the waters. And what better than watch another country test the waters sitting far away and see what happens? So Turkey was a country that I used to watch a lot, especially its tackling of inflation. And one continues to actually appreciate the fact that it's been a very innovative environment in terms of macroeconomic policymaking. South-South trade. I want to give you a quick glimpse now of the increase of that. Yeah, here is a picture of South-South trade. And you will see the growth of trade of the southern countries with southern countries, so developing and emerging economies with developing and emerging economies. 1960, just short of 15% of imports of developing countries would be from developing countries. Developing, I'm using developing and emerging. And by the early 2000, it was just short of 30%. And some recent data crunching by the World Bank shows that between 2010 and 2011, southern countries' imports from southern countries has just crossed 50%. So there is an element of resilience beginning to build up, and I'm going to come on to this theme about southern resilience, which is needed in today's troubled world. But I want to warn you that it is very easy to begin to think that the resilience is huge, which it is not. It's a very interconnected world, and I'll show you the Lehman crisis, which is quite fascinating. It's basically, think of this as borrowing cost of developing country sovereigns. Lehman crisis takes place in the US, and the borrowing cost for developing country governments just shoot up. It's a sign of the interconnected world. And let me give you one example where I was hands-on working, and this was going to link me up with some very important and interesting intricacies of the interconnected world. In August 2011, I was still in Delhi doing my previous job as a chief economic advisor to the government, when S&P's downgraded the U.S., U.S. investment was downgraded by S&P's, and I remember the evening when the news came. I was in Delhi, we got the news, and we were wondering what's going to happen. The U.S. economy is going to be rocked a bit. India should be fine in the short run, but we will feel the pressures in the long run. But what happened was actually fascinating. Money started flowing into the United States treasuries. So after S&P's downgrade of U.S., money is flowing into U.S. treasuries. So you are seeing this effect on the exchange rate in India. You're seeing this in Brazil. You're seeing this in South Africa. Even Europe, barring Germany, is seeing money being pulled out and going into the U.S. treasuries. What has happened? Analyzing that gives you a glimpse of the changing structure of the world economy. This is investors looking for safety. And where do you find safety? Well, you want to put in your money into bonds of governments which also have the assurance that the government can pay you back. This means that if there is a weak economy, you worry about that. Or if you have an economy which may be strong, but without its own central bank, you worry about that economy's ability to pay you back. So putting money in U.S. treasuries is safe because you know that the U.S. has access to a central bank. And the last thing that the U.S. would want is to default on an international investment that has been made in the U.S. The central bank, the Fed, is going to step in. This had gone from Europe by this time. There are European countries which are, by any global standard, strong global economies, but they don't have their own central banks anymore. If you put in money with Spain or France or Italy, when the time comes to pay back, they don't have that access anymore. Printing money to pay back is not a good idea, but it's a last measure that if there is a central bank that you could get that bank to do it. If you don't have a central bank, you don't have an assurance. So money which earlier would have gone into Europe did not go into Europe because it's a different Europe. It's the Eurozone with one central bank. I should stress over here. I do believe that the Eurozone experiment is the right experiment. It's the right direction to go. Just that, when you make such a big deliberate construction of an economic structure, it's not surprising that fault lines will show. Most of the economic practices that you see today in the world have evolved slowly over time, and the forces of evolution have buffeted them, corrected them. So over time, the rules that we follow in terms of the management of the economy through evolutionary processes, if not through understanding, have got corrected and the bad practices have fallen out. Europe was a deliberate construction. It did not have the advantage of 100 years of evolutionary correction. So it's not surprising that fault lines would show, and fault lines did show. So money rushed into the U.S. at that time, and we, for the first time, we see this happening, the exchange rate in India beginning to move, and we realized that globalization has changed the landscape. Let me turn to one picture I'll show, and then I want to move on and do a little bit of without picture. This is the Eurozone. I like this picture because it illustrates a dramatic feature of what happened in the Eurozone and the fault line that I was talking about. I want you to understand this, and you'll get an intuitive understanding even without getting into the details. What I'm tracking here is from 1999, borrowing costs of Eurozone countries. So roughly think of this as a sovereign borrowing cost of the sovereigns. On the formation of the Eurozone, people, not only policymakers, they did not understand, no one properly understood, even investors, treated all the Eurozone countries roughly the same. So you invest money in Spain, you invest money in Germany. The safety of that is the same because now they are one common currency area, the Eurozone. So the borrowing cost of Spain and borrowing cost of Italy and borrowing cost of Germany was the same. And so in the beginning, if you look at the borrowing costs, they are virtually the same from 1999 to roughly 2008. 2008, it dawns on people that, yes, the Eurozone is a monetary union, but each country can default separately. Spain can default when Germany does not default. So the risk of lending to these countries should not be treated as the same. And once that realization came, the borrowing costs suddenly fanned out. Some countries would have to pay a huge interest to be able to borrow because people realized they are risky. Others would have to pay a very low interest to be able to borrow because they were not risky. This realization that came in some ways too late, because what happened before that was that because of the lowered cost of borrowing from many economies which should have had a higher cost of borrowing, they overborrowed. So by the time we wake up in 2009, there has been fiscal profligacy, huge fiscal profligacy on the part of a whole host of countries, and now we are grappling with that. And I do agree that jumping to austerity is not the right way to go. There has been fiscal profligacy in the past. You can see this in the debt-GDP ratio and in terms of many other fiscal indicators, but you have to use a combination of very well-crafted policies. So with that, I want to, where do we stand today and what do we expect to see over the next few years? And then I want to turn to a couple of policy challenges and once again putting those policy challenges from the point of view of the developing countries. You know, forecasting is such a hazardous task that one hesitates to do that. What will the next 2 years look like? But let me stick my neck out and in the early 1960s in Calcutta, in an uncle's home, there used to be a letter from President Kennedy congratulating this uncle for correctly predicting Kennedy's election victory, the 1960, the famous election victory, for correctly forecasting. My uncle used to display it very proudly in his home. And we, the cynical nephews and nieces, believed that the uncle had managed to get that letter from Kennedy by sending an identical letter to Nixon, predicting his victory as well, so that no matter who won, my uncle would get a letter for his wall. Now, that's the strategy that economists at times use. I mean, you hedge your bets by saying so many things that no matter what happens, you'll be right. There's another ploy that, not quite ploy, there are some people who will always predict doom, and then sometime when the doom happens, of course, they've got it right. Or some people always predict a boom, and when that happens, you've got it right. Let me not do those, and let me stick my neck out and try to give you a relatively clear belief, and with all the question marks, the future is uncertain. I believe that this crisis-like situation will last for at least another 2 years. And the reason for that belief is that what we are seeing around the world, policy moves which are right, but they are not solving anything. The injection of liquidity that you're seeing around the world from Japan, United States, Bank of England, Swiss National Bank, all these injections are buying time. The ECB, they are buying time, but they are not solving problems. And some of this injection took place in huge doses at the end of 2011 and at the beginning of 2012. In fact, 1.3 trillion euros injected, sorry, 1.3 trillion dollars, no, 1.3 trillion dollars, yes, about 1 trillion euros. I was getting the currencies wrong, injected into banks in Europe, which will have to be paid back 3 years down the road, end of 2014, 2015. There is no sign that these are being invested in ways where the repayment is going to be easy. So there is a very good chance that there'll have to be one more round of injection at that time to, again, keep the banks buoyant. So the injection of liquidity that has taken place, and if I was at the helm taking these decisions, I would do the same, is what had to be done, but they've bought us time. They have not cured any of the problems. The two big problems that we need to attend to, one is fiscal coordination in Europe, better fiscal coordination in Europe, and the other is banking union. Well-structured banking union, we do know that this creates some strange political problems of within Eurozone countries taking one view and EU countries which are not in the Eurozone taking another view because it will be a united banking union of one group. So there are tensions. We don't know whether that will happen. But there are other policies that we have to go in for to meet this challenge of the current times. Look at the fallout of this for the world of not being able to solve the problem. This injection of liquidity does create certain kinds of problems which Turkey has faced, India has faced, China has faced. It's around the world. There has been generally, over the last 3 years, if you look at the global economy, it's a strange kind of stagflation. It's not stag and flation in the same place, but stag in some places and flation in some places. Most industrialized countries are stagnating. Eurozone is technically in recession. So Japan has been stagnant for a very, very long time. But developing countries, emerging economies, where growth has been extremely buoyant. Turkey, last year's growth was not good, but before that, Turkey was growing extremely well for a very long time. India, last year's growth was not good, but before that, India was growing phenomenally well. But all these countries, Vietnam, even China, growing well, but with a problem of inflation. Earlier, what macroeconomic policymakers were doing in emerging economies was that they were responding to the injection of liquidity in the industrialized world by trying to drain the liquidity in emerging economies, which was giving rise to a strange tension, liquidity being injected at one end and being taken out at another end. That policy has begun to change. Most emerging economies are not doing that anymore. You are beginning to see the lowering of interest rates, repo rates, call money rates are beginning to go down in emerging economies. So they are not doing what they were doing earlier. And this is giving rise to a new set of problems. Where should we go from here to solve the global problem? And my interest really is from the point of view of emerging economies for the following reason. Industrialized countries, even if they grow slowly, they are rich countries. A slow growth for them is not a dramatic event, excepting the unemployment situation, and I will comment on that. If a country like the United States, Europe, if they can grow at 2% per annum, which would be considered extremely bad performance for an emerging economy or a developing country, 2% per annum would be very good performance. For me, that would be moving towards a stable world with a fair amount of employment, the employment situation much better. The problem really is in developing countries that even though they are growing well still with a mass of poverty. In a country like India, there is about 30% of the population is below the poverty line, and a poverty line that is drawn very, very low. $1.25 per person per day, about 30% of the population is below that line. Sub-Saharan Africa, 48.5% of the population below that line of $1.25 a day. At times you hear from activists saying that, why do you draw the poverty line so low? Indeed, that's a valid question. But you must realize that if even after drawing it so low, you find so much of the population below that line, that is a worrying feature of the world. So the present crisis of the world economy is true, the crisis is brewing in industrialized countries, but it's our primary focus has to be the developing countries and the low-income countries, where the consequence of this, even if it's a tiny growth change, the consequence of this can be quite dramatic. What should be the policy moves? I have three suggestions, but the third one is slightly technical, and I'm going to look at my time, and then I'll certainly give you the first two thoughts that I have, and the third one I may or may not give you. First of all, I feel that in today's world, the need for macroeconomic policy coordination is greater than ever before. And one fact which I keep pointing to, but I think it's just so very important for us to understand, that when in the 17th century, these central banks were coming up, one after another, Riksbank in Sweden, Bank of England, 1694, there was an understanding that a single economy ought to have a single money-creating authority. That's one domain where you don't want competition. However, so lots of banks came up around the world. I think there must be more than 200 central banks around the world. One nation, one economy, one central bank. But since then, something has changed in the global economy, which I began with. The globalization in economics of the world means that the world is increasingly becoming like a single economy. I know that there are still lots of restrictions and barriers, but capital does flow fairly easily. Goods flow not quite as easily, but goods do flow, and increasingly, and maybe over the last 20 years, last 15 years, labor is beginning to flow easily. At times by the workers moving, at times with the job moving to where the workers are sitting. So it's a very united economy, the global economy is becoming. But we've created lots of central banks. So the predicament that we had tried to get out of in the 17th century, one economy with one central bank, we are back again into a situation where you have one economy but with lots of central banks because the walls fell off somewhere along the lines. This, we are not going to very soon see the creation of a single central bank. The one experiment in Europe has put a bit of a slowdown to the process of the creation of a single central bank. But we do need policy coordination. I think that's extremely important. Take the current situation. Japan injecting liquidity. I have to say, I personally believe that if you look at the last sort of 10 years of the Japanese exchange rate, Japan had to do it. It is a highly overvalued exchange rate, which was slowing down the economy and slowing down the world. Japan has made that move with a gusto, let me say, in terms of injecting liquidity. But what that has resulted in is that others are sitting up, and there will probably be similar moves. We are seeing, first of all, in Japan, the latest data coming in is that most economic activity, industrial activity is going up. So the injection of liquidity is playing a role. But I don't think it's going to play a role for a very long time because other countries are going to make similar moves of injection of liquidity. And yes, each country will talk in terms of boosting domestic demand, but this also has implications for the exchange rate every time you're doing that. One thing we do need minimally is cluster of large economies, and this includes not just the industrialized economies, but must include emerging economies, even the poorer but large economies, their central banks have to come together and think in terms of a coordinated central bank policy. So that if it could be announced that 20 countries with their 20 central banks sat down and they have laid out the following course for the global economy for the next 3 months. In the beginning, country X is going to inject liquidity. Then 1 month later, country Y will inject a certain amount of liquidity. A roadmap gets laid out. I've been told in the World Bank not to name countries too many times. So I'm staying with X and Y, which countries will be given that advice. So X is told to inject some liquidity. Y is told to inject some liquidity a little bit later. If you can lay out a roadmap of this kind, the speculation that comes with a country unilaterally declaring a policy is going to go down. Also, the exchange rate movements that you get, if it can be a coordinated move, the movement on the exchange rate can go down, so the creation of greater liquidity in your country can take place without that injection of liquidity. Also, concerns of carry trade. Today are huge concerns. I know Turkey is extremely worried about that, that with these interest rate variations, which come with central bank policy variations across the world, it's possible to go and borrow in one country where the interest rate is low and then use it in a country where the interest rate is high. You're borrowing at a very low interest rate and using it in a country where interest rate is high, or even through secondary channels lending it in a country where interest rate is high, which means you're arbitraging on the interest rate. India, where capital account convertibility is limited, we know that in indirect ways, a certain amount of carry trade and interest rate arbitrage takes place. So there is great need for that coordination. Second policy, which again, the whole world needs to put its mind together. The labor problem, I feel, is going to get worse over time. What we are seeing in the world, Michael Spence has done some calculations that the total wage bill as a share of the global GDP is shrinking. So the income that comes through work, pure labor, that income is becoming a smaller part of the global GDP pie, which means people are now earning money through many other sources. You're earning as profit, you've got a piece of paper which gives you returns, so the labor share is decreasing. This is going to be a long-run challenge for the world to do with the shifts in tectonic plates of the world that I was talking about earlier. As the demand for labor goes down in the world, the first pressure for this will be felt in industrialized countries where the wages are higher, and you are seeing that pressure. So the high unemployments that are being seen around the world, Europe is now at, 12.1% unemployment. US is 7.7% unemployment, which does not sound that high, but you have to remember that of that 7.7% unemployed in the U.S., 39.5, just short of 40% of those unemployed are long-term unemployed, which is very unusual in the U.S. In the U.S., the unemployment is typically of people falling into that and then getting out of it, whereas now there are 40% of the unemployed are long-term unemployed, and there are studies which show that you begin to de-skill when you're long-term unemployed, so when you go back to the labor force, you're not quite as effective. I think the labor situation is quite dire. Part of this comes from the changing structure of the global labor force, but a part of this also has to do with policy, which can be attended to once again through a little bit of a coordinated special policy intervention. And this is the policy intervention that you need in industrialized countries. When you inject this liquidity into the economy, industrialized country economy, as I just said, it will typically go with interest rates going very low, and interest rates are indeed very, very low. Interest rates are high in countries, in emerging economies, with the carry trade problem which they have to face. But when interest rates go so low, think of a firm in the United States or in Europe. Your capital cost is going down because liquidity is being injected. So tiny calculation changes begin to take place on the margin that labor is relatively more expensive than capital because capital cost has gone down. So the incentive to employ more labor does not take place when there is so much of liquidity injection taking place. That needs to be corrected. Here you have to be very cautious, because, and I don't want to put down anything as a sort of final word on how that needs to be corrected, but my view is that when liquidity is being injected through asset purchase, which is what typically central banks tend to do, you buy mortgage-backed securities or something else, $85 billion per month that, for instance, the United States is doing, one way to begin to correct the asymmetry in the borrowing, in the cost of labor and capital that this gives rise to, is to inject a part of this money to make hiring of labor more worthwhile for firms. This has to be a strategic intervention on the marginal cost of borrowing. Subsidy for employment is the direct way to do it on the margin. For a temporary period, if you do it for 6 months, 1 year, so of the $85 billion being injected, part of this being done to get the demand for labor buoyed up. If this can be done in Europe, if this can be done in the US, Japan, across the world, you will begin to create greater employment. Once you create the greater employment, since a part of the problem today is a trap, it's an equilibrium in which these economies are caught. Once the workers begin to work, they will create demand for goods. And that's a much better way to create demand for goods, by workers actually going and wanting to buy more instead of trying to do it through liquidity, pure liquidity injection. So tilting this in a particular way can do it. The third topic that I would have talked of is somewhat disjointed, so I will not talk about it. It's on the nature of central bank interventions, and it is probably to do with a little bit more theory, since Kemal had first corresponded with me about this topic, and I know Kemal's background as a mathematical economist. I had a few pictures to demonstrate how central banks will intervene, but I've just given you a foretaste by telling you that I have that with me, but I will not present that over here. But with these words, let me stop here, and I'll be happy to continue through questions, comments, or however you want to do it. Thank you very much.
Dr. Basu, I would love to thank you for such an enriching and enlightening presentation here. But I think I also need to make a confession that I wish the organizers had given us an extra 10-15 minutes to digest the presentation, particularly the technical aspects of it, the parts that relate to policy recommendations. However, as I was listening to your policy recommendations, particularly the very first one on sequencing of injections, I couldn't help but think that somewhere along the line, politics needs to be taken into consideration, and wondered how countries are going to be able to agree upon who's going to be the first one to go. The way we're going to proceed with the rest of the program today is I'll turn the floor to my colleague Isak Atias at Sabancı University. We will be taking two or three questions. I suspect there will be a number on the Istanbul side of this event, and surely from the audience here as well. I do have lots of questions in mind. And one of them is that at times I've heard you say that experts know so much more than non-experts is how little experts know in general. I remain very puzzled with that statement, particularly as I listened to your presentation. But let me turn to my good friend and colleague, Isak. Hello, Isak, and hi to everybody in at Sabancı University's campuses. I would especially love to salute the students there, Güler Sabancı, who's an old schoolmate of mine from back Ankara, as well as the rest. Isak, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much,
Kemal, and thank you, Kaushik, for a wonderful presentation, very thought-provoking presentation. At the risk of sounding provincial, maybe just a small comment on Turkey. You mentioned it's her very remarkable performance, and indeed it was remarkable the last decade, especially compared to the earlier decades. And another remarkable aspect of this high growth rate is that it was very much productivity driven. In other words, when you look at productivity growth, whether you measure it as labor productivity or total factor productivity, it's high international comparison, and it's high relative to the earlier decades as well. So that's happy news, I guess. However, when you look into the dynamics behind this productivity growth, when you decompose it this way or that way, you find out that a lot of it is really reallocation of resources, especially labor, from low productivity agriculture to high productivity industry and services, rather than productivity growth within these industries. So there was a lot of structural change going on, and same with exports. There was a lot of structural change going on with exports. We used to export mainly garments, textiles, food and beverages, and now we export a lot of automobiles, steel and chemicals. But still, when you look at the details of those exports, you find that Turkey still does not export a lot of sophisticated goods. The share of sophisticated goods, the share of high technology goods is still low. So there are lots of economists in Turkey. On the one hand, we're happy about the growth performance of the last decade. At the same time, there's a lot of talk about whether we're still facing, I don't know whether to call it the middle income trap, but it seems as if Turkey is on the verge of a threshold, and a lot depends on what type of policies are adopted from now on. And I wonder if you have any words of wisdom related to that. And having said that, let me turn to the audience here and see, look for questions. Okay, if you could please introduce yourself as well.
Hi, my name is Korhan Koçak, and I'm a first-year master's student in Sabancı University. I'd like to ask you, referring to the ongoing disputes regarding the famous paper by Reinhardt and Rogoff, Growth in a Time of Debt, and keeping in mind the speed with which Northern European countries recovered from the financial crisis using austerity, would it be safe to say that the austerity versus stimulus debate is finally over?
Thank you, Korhan. Let me take one more question, and then I'll switch it over to Kemal. Okay, over there.
Hi, Kaşık. This is Meryl Kiefer. I have two questions to you. Should emerging nations have any controls on the flow of capital in and out of their countries? What about the problem of hot money issue? And second question, would it be wise idea for emerging nations to consider joining a currency union like the EU, and or that has that now being shown to be a bad idea?
Thank you very much, and over to you, Kemal.
Thank you, Isak.
Kaushik, if you want to respond.
Dr. Basu, you have the questions.
Yeah.
We look forward to the comments.
Very good. Let me respond briefly to Kamal Zia, Isak, and then the two questions. The last one from a friend of mine from Cornell, Meral Kiefer. The politics of this, which you're referring to, is, of course, there beneath the surface all the time. And if you're naive, you realize that by going into a policymaking domain. I don't think I was naive. So when I went into Indian policymaking, mm-hmm. I realized the importance of politics. A decision that in a closed room, the policymakers will all be able to agree. But they can't take that decision because that immediately has ramifications in terms of the votes, in terms of electoral response of the electorate. So that's extremely important, and it sort of merges with how you manage to carry these out. The reason I'm hopeful that we will get better macroeconomic policy coordination today is at times a pain is a sufficient trigger. When there is pain, that becomes a trigger for a change, that change which for reasons of politics you are not being able to implement, you may be able to do so. So I believe there is a chance now that mm-hmm. politics will be overcome because the economic pain is becoming large. Turkey I used to follow when I said I probably overstated that. I can't really get into the details of Turkish policy to say whether the range of policies followed till now will continue to serve the country well. What I do know is that, say, around 2010, 2011, what was quite remarkable about Turkey was that it was growing, first of all, very rapidly, I mean, 8-9% per annum. It was getting that growth with a current account deficit, which is very high. And so, in fact, we kept thinking that this was going to be a destabilizing level of current account deficit. In Turkey, if I'm not mistaken, the current account deficit touched 10% once, came down to 9, 8, 7, but all these are extremely high. Turkey was managing through that. And one particular move that Turkey made around that time was, in the middle of this inflation, the central bank lowered the interest rates. And we were all watching that to see what will that do. Is it going to give another boost to inflation? It did not really do that. Inflation continued to fall after that, and the growth remained buoyant. So the policies which we watched over 10 and 11 were pretty good policies. But whether this will carry on, whether the growth will continue, that's another deeper question for which I don't have enough deep knowledge of Turkey. But one general wisdom I will bring from the world. You know, I used to treat one textbookish theory as a textbookish theory and nothing else, which is the relationship between growth and investment. This is the, whether you talk of Harold Domar or Solow and Swan, this is there in our textbooks. But for emerging economies and for developing countries, this will not hold, by the way, for industrialized countries, the relationship between higher investment, especially if it can be infrastructural investment, and growth is very, very strong. In the case of India, this was just extremely visible. India used to be a low-saving country through the 50s, 60s, early 70s. India's savings rate picked up very rapidly through the 1970s. India's growth picked up slowly from the 1980s. India's savings rate in the early 2000, 2001, 2003, really picked up, and India was beginning to save and invest like East Asian countries. 35-36% of the national income was being invested. And 2 years after that, India was growing at 9.5% per annum for three consecutive years. The relation comes whether you look at Korea, whether you look at Malaysia, Thailand, Singapore, a bit earlier, China, it comes. I think China does overinvest a little bit, so it gets a lot of bang for the buck of its investment. But the last bit of China's investment probably does not get it enough bang for the buck, because it is investing about 50%. But Turkey's figures I do not know, but infrastructural investment, investment which increases productivity, and Isaac, I take it that that's what you were referring to in terms of keeping productivity high and getting into more sophisticated sectors. Indeed, that is important. With that, let me go into the question, the first student who asked about the austerity debate, is it over? No. The newspaper debate, the magazine debate, usually takes place in such simplistic terms. Is austerity good or bad? You know, a question like that really strictly cannot be answered. It depends on what kind of austerity you're talking about. One thing has to be kept in mind, that if your debt to GDP ratio is 100% or 120%, which it is for several countries in the world, going up to 200% for Japan, if there has been such a big build-up of debt, you have to go the direction of trying to wind that down, which does mean a certain form of austerity.
But that form is extremely important. To me, the critical question is not whether you go for austerity or not, but it's the distribution of austerity. When you are trying to correct for overconsumption in the past, what you have to make sure is that the burden does not go on the weakest and the poorest sections of your society. The World Bank is engaged, going to be engaged with this in one particular way, because the World Bank has declared that a new attention is going to be paid by the World Bank to the bottom 40% of every country, including the industrialized countries. And a policy of the kind that I'm talking about is when you go for austerity, the austerity that the richer segments will have to do some curbing, I think that is true. But the poorer segments of the society should not have to do that. So the critical change in the debate, I think, which will hopefully come out of the huge controversy that you saw over the last week or so, is that the austerity debate is going to become more sophisticated discussion, because some fiscal, putting the fiscal house in order, you have to do that. But how you do put that fiscal house in order and how do you coordinate it with other countries is the critical question. In fact, my hope is that what was a very, very naive debate will now, in fact, become a more sophisticated debate, the austerity debate. Meral, your question about capital flows, well, I do believe that emerging countries, developing countries, you have to use a certain amount of judicial controls on capital flows. You can't just open the door and say, let capital come sloshing in, capital goes sloshing out freely. It does lead to kinds of problems that you have to worry about. Having said that, this has to be kept in mind by any government, that once you give government the plate, that this is the domain in which you intervene, there is very often a tendency to over-intervene. So this has to be a very well-planned intervention that you don't allow for excessive volatility of capital. And that indeed does closely connect to the question that you asked. Is it worthwhile for emerging economies to move towards currency unions? My belief in this is very similar to a belief that was expressed in the late 18th century. Stanley Jevons, the British economist, wrote about global currencies. This is not a very well-known work. And maybe he was a bit too early writing about that, so it got no traction when Jevons wrote about it. But the idea is that economies that are similarly placed, for them to move towards a currency union, I think is the right direction to go. So though we've had our fingers burnt through the Eurozone experiment, broadly for economies at similar levels to move towards currency unions or currency coordinations of certain kinds, I feel is the direction that in which you have to go, for the reason that I mentioned during the lecture, that we understood this in the 17th century, that if you have your borders open to labor, to capital, to goods, to have the money-creating authorities, have multiple money-creating authorities is destabilizing. And we are in that terrain in the world. So some move towards currency unions, even in these difficult times with the Eurozone experiment, is a direction in which we have to go. Hopefully we've taken lessons from the Eurozone, so many of the fault lines we will avoid on this occasion.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Dr. Basuga. I can't help again wonder whose currency it's going to be, and that may also reflect on. The way we would like to go this, if you could just briefly present yourself, introduce yourself, and then brief questions, two, three questions.
Robert Schroeder with International Investor. I'd like you to address the issue of contagion. We've seen both the World Bank and the IMF continue to ratchet down their projections for world GDP growth. You mentioned in one of your charts that south-on-south trade is growing, but they still depend to a significant degree on trade with the developed world, sending their commodities, etc. So as the developed world has slowed down, are you still concerned that the contagion effect will slow down many other economies as well?
Yeah. Yes, sir. Right here in the front. It's coming, the micro.
Hi, Richard Shin with Economist Inc. I have a question about your international macroeconomic policy coordination. Obviously, you know, Dr. Qureshi mentioned, you know, political side of it and how difficult it is. But you know, also, there's a difficulty in coming to an economic understanding among these countries. And you mentioned, you know, developed countries and emerging countries, but they have different incentives, and how do you coordinate that within that group? Is how would you overcome that? That's the first question. And the related question is that you mentioned that liquidity could be interjected into labor-intensive firms or sectors to create more jobs and henceforth kickstart your growth. But on the other hand, if you do more labor-intensive liquidity, that will be more domestic-oriented and therefore less international interaction. Therefore, you know, that may reduce the need for international macroeconomic coordination. And so I'd like to know what's the balance there that you're trying to reach with your two policy recommendations.
Okay, Dr. Basu.
Yeah. Robert Schrader there. On the contagion, the South-South, let me first take on that. The increase in South-South trade, I'm actually fully with the suggestion in your question. It gives you a little more resilience, but just a little bit more. The trade with the North is extremely important. Also, it's very different kinds of products and services on which with which you trade with the North. And if I, again, look at the country that I know very well from my last experience, take India's software and information technology sector. Of the exports that go out of India, 60% is to the U.S. alone. So the importance of that relation is absolutely critical. So, I mean, South-South relation is not going to make up for that very quickly, so that is well taken. On contagion, here is the point. The real contagion in terms of a slowdown in growth affecting another part because of these factors that trade goes down, your scope for export goes down, yes, that's going to happen. But there's another aspect to contagion which is more worrying and less understood, is financial contagion. This takes place through very strange psychological routes. You know, there's a lot of rather abstruse writing in economics on financial contagion, but we must not push that aside as abstruse writing. There is something to be said on how these financial contagions take place. If you remember the 1997, the East Asian crisis, it was sparking off from one country to another and in more distant countries. Suddenly Russia is getting affected by what's going on in East Asian countries, and you can't quite track it through trade routes, but it is the investor psychology. What happens basically is when one is lending to a particular country or a particular corporation, if you know that other people are lending also to this organization or to this government, without doing too much homework about whether it is safe to lend or not, you continue to lend because you know that others are lending. So when you want to pull out, it's easy for you to pull out. But this kind of reasoning leads to a very strange brew. Everyone is lending because everybody yes. else is lending. And this can suddenly fuse and vanish when everyone pulls out of it because it's the interdependence. This kind of contagion, which happens in the finance world, because everyone is watching every other investor as to how they are behaving, is a more worrying part of the contagion. And that sort of underlies my statement about the capital account controls, which I talked about earlier, is we don't fully understand the financial contagion. As I mentioned, there is abstruse work in finance trying to get to grips with it, but we are not at grips with it. In the meantime, what you want is some relatively ham-handed measures, like some minimal capital controls, which you can use to suddenly bring into check a contagion which is spreading from one country to another. You do want that instrument to be there with the central bank and with the government. Policy coordination. To clarify, the developed countries and emerging countries, the coordination. The coordination does not mean, and I should have clarified on that, that everybody is doing the same thing. So it is not that these 20 countries, which will have, say, 10 industrialized countries, 5 emerging economies, 5 developing countries, large developing countries, say, Indonesia, India, Brazil, you're not going to say that all of them are going to tighten liquidity. You sit down like in a G20-type forum and take a decision that, well, we feel that in this situation, India can go in for an injection of liquidity, of tightening of liquidity, whereas the U.S. should behave in a different way. So there are different lines that you take. But if this comes out with a collective announcement, then immediately the speculation that countries are at war with one another, that is going to go out because it's a collective decision. How do you take this collective decision? There is going to be a lot of arm twisting, we know that. As soon as you sit in a room with the big and the powerful and the relatively weaker, there will be arm twisting. But it is choosing between two evils. Completely free-flowing decisions being taken in different units in a world which is a strange world where the economies come together, but there are lots of central banks. We are getting this in another domain, by the way, taxation. You are seeing certain corporate races in terms of corporate taxation beginning to take place in the world. Tax havens being created. OECD has been writing about this. So you do need this even in the taxation domain. Once again, it does not mean that you're going to recommend the same policies for the rich and the poor countries, but it's a coordinated, some semblance of a coordinated announcement will make a difference. The labor injection, the liquidity that I'm talking about, it's not that you do it only in the domestic sector. You do it within your country, but that does not mean that it's not going to affect your trade sector, your import sector. It could indeed go across the board within your country.
Thank you, Dr. Kbus. Isaac, I think we still have a little bit time for another two questions, really quickly and snappily.
Yeah, coming. And don't forget to introduce yourself.
Oh, we're not hearing the questions.
Is it okay? Yeah. Okay. Hi, I'm an international student from Pakistan, and my question is, how can Turkey's possible inclusion into the EU affect its economic performance? Is it still wise for it to be part of the EU, keeping in mind EU's economic crisis? Thank you.
Very good. Thanks. This is a question we've been pondering about for some time.
Thank you. I'm Rehan. I'm a junior studying economics. You have put a lot of emphasis on the need for global policy coordination. And we have also talked about EU having a problematic experience with implementing policy coordination. However, I would like to ask how much the recent experience of the EU in responding to global crisis hindered the feasibility of having a policy coordination in the international level in the future?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Very good question. Yeah. Dr. Basu?
Yes. Okay.
Thanks, Isaac.
Thank you very much. For the first question from the student from my neighboring country, Pakistan. I hope your question had remained pantomime so that I hadn't heard it. Then I wouldn't have to answer it. It's a question about whether Turkey should join EU or not. You know, I can't give you an answer on that because I really just don't know enough of the details on the ground, but I can give you some of the logic that Turkey has to weigh in taking a decision of this kind. It is the following thing that has to be kept in mind, that your trade channels open up hugely. That's a big benefit. But your exchange rate correction methods go down. You get great limitations on what you can do. There is a lot of new literature on fiscal devaluations, but we know that there are limits to the fiscal devaluation. This is the big trade-off that has to be weighed. Think of the East Asian crisis, 1997. The crisis was deep when it hit in 1997. 2 years later, the crisis was virtually over. Yes, it lingered on for a while in Indonesia, but most countries pulled out. What happened during this time was massive exchange rate corrections. So deep crisis, huge exchange rate corrections, you pull out of this. Once you are a part of a union, that correction method, of course, goes because you can't make that kind of an exchange rate correction anymore. But on the other hand, there is an advantage of a market opening up. And my instincts are always in terms of trade, the more open that you can be, goods flowing easily from one region to another, one country to another, is beneficial. But there is a trade-off involved, and I will leave this hard question for you to ponder about and take a decision on. Rehan, if I got your name right, again, you're right. Every setback in a major experiment, like the Eurozone experiment, I think of the Eurozone experiment as the second biggest deliberate human experiment in terms of economic structures. The biggest deliberate experiment was the formation of the communist economy. Mm-hmm. The second biggest is the Eurozone economy. I think the Eurozone experiment is a move in the desirable direction, in the right direction. But with this huge experiment and the fault lines that showed up, this indeed is a setback for future coordination. But here is what I would tell the policymakers at the helm, that, you know, we are lucky that this experiment took place and the fault lines showed up. And really, some of these fault lines, as that borrowing chart of sovereign bonds demonstrated, that till 2008, we were blissfully unaware of the fault lines. Then comes the Lehman crisis, and we understand what the fault lines are. Next time, when there is policy coordination going on, you don't have to worry about those particular fault lines because we've understood that. So it is a huge experiment which has given us a level of understanding that we could have never have got. So in fact, instead of shying away from future policy coordination, if we are rational, if we have wisdom out of this, we will go, in fact, now move boldly towards a few more steps in policy coordination because we've learned from the failures, or not quite failures, but the stumbling blocks that the Eurozone hit upon.
I know this is not going to be very diplomatic, but I feel a little bit let down with the answer you gave to our Pakistani friend. I thought you were going to say an unequivocal yes and leave it at that. I think we have a little more time for two questions. Yes, please.
Hi, I'm Jayda Önar from the International Monetary Fund. You drew a pretty grim outlook for developing economies. You mentioned that the crisis is going to continue and things won't be looking up for a while. You mentioned the hyperconnectivity. Given that advanced economies won't be doing very well, it's going to affect developing economies. And then Professor Ishak mentioned the middle income trap, and that, mm-hmm. you know, in the longer term, you know, given how we came to the high growth rates, you know, it doesn't look very good that they'll continue. Now, these are fundamentally two different ways of, you know, presenting the outlook. One is a bit more cyclical. The advanced economies aren't doing very well, and that's why developing economies won't be either. Versus, regardless of the crisis and regardless of the emerging markets, the development model of developing economies was in a way inherently built to slow down. How do we square mm-hmm. these two? Which one do you think weighs more?
Yeah. Let me clarify. Actually,
can we take one more
sure,
question?
Sure, please, go ahead.
Yes, please. Yeah.
Thank you. John Sitalides with Trilogy Advisors. Sir, you opened your presentation with a discussion about the fact that we live in a world marked by economic globalization and fragmented politics. And yet I hear in your remarks and in those of many others in distinguished positions about the call for greater union, fiscal union, currency union, banking union. And yet we also see around the world the strong preference of societies, of nation states, for sovereign democratic politics. And I ask you, how do you address this inherent tension between the call of the elite for more union and the call of people for sovereign democratic politics as a means of free expression? Thank you.
While I have you, I had a question that I'd been dying to ask. As I listened to Stroke Talbot and you two made references to the 60s, I did most of my learning in the 70s. And at that time, for the South, a very grim picture used to be drawn. And the likelihood of the South playing a major role in world economy was not being brought up. If anything, it was doomsday scenarios. What brought us here, if a quick answer is possible? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Not a quick one, but I'll try. Yeah.
The first question from the IMF, just to clarify. I feel it's, in terms of the description of the terrain ahead, it's not that we are going to dip into a crisis. There was a fear, I think, end of 2011, early 2012, that Europe is going to plunge into a crisis. That has abated. If you look at financial indicators in particular, yes, we have got an occasional sudden sharp crisis like the Cyprus one happened and has abated for a while, but most financial indicators suggest that there is an improvement in terms of the financial risk, which can come very quickly, very sharp. The real economy risks usually don't move as sharp. I am saying that what is a disappointing scenario is the growth seen in front of us. See, I was very hopeful that the U.S. is going to pull out very quickly. What has got me a bit worried is one particular indicator, which people don't pay too much attention to, but to me, actually, it's extremely important, which is retail purchases by consumers and consumer confidence. That is this thing which gets tracked by Reuters and the University of Michigan on retailer confidence. Last year, that was doing pretty well for the U.S., so I was hoping that this is going to begin to pull the U.S. out quicker. But that confidence indicator has taken a dip over the last couple of months, which is a bit of a worrying sign. And the employment, in particular, the long-term employment is worrying. And in Europe, as I said, that the injection of liquidity has bought itself time. It has caused the financial crisis risks to abate, but the growth scenario does remain grim. So the growth scenario is what remains grim. And now the connection between the industrialized world and the developing and the emerging world, I feel, and this is talking about the very long run, is there is a shift in tectonic plates taking place. In some sense, the driver of the global economy, that baton, is being passed on from industrialized countries to emerging economies. When you have in a relay race also, when you see a baton actually being passed, there's a bit of a slowdown takes place for both the person passing and the person picking it up. And that's the best analogy that I can give. So right now, the entire world is being rocked, and the slowdown in growth that you are seeing is not just in industrialized countries where it's zero, negative, low negative, or 0.3 in UK. So it's just hovering around zero growth, but there's a slowdown everywhere. Brazil is down to 2%, less than 2%. India's down to around 5%. China's down to 7.7%. So it's down everywhere. It's taking place. But I feel we are going to come out of this, not in the next 2 years, but after that, when we come out of it, my expectation is we are going to see faster growth resume in the emerging economies. Which ones, I don't quite know. But there will be a bunch of emerging economies that will really become the drivers of global growth. The best scenario we can go back to, and I'm optimistic that we will go back to that, is the industrialized countries get back to a 2% growth per annum, which for rich countries is, if they can hold that stable with decent employment, and the emerging economies go back to, again, the kinds of growth that you were seeing, 8%, 9%, 7 to 9% growth for a couple of powerful emerging economies, 2-3 years down the road, I feel is a very, very possible scenario. John, banking union, and democracy.
Sovereign democracy.
Sovereign democracy, this is a big question. And you know, that we would always say even in the earlier, in the olden times of Washington consensus, that to a developing country, you go and say that, look, you people must vote, you people must choose your own policy, and here are the policies that you will choose. There's a contradiction in terms when you do that. We live with that contradiction. And the currency union, the only way that I can talk to this is that, and I would face that actually in India, because there would be civil society protests about some of these policy moves that, yes, sitting in New Delhi, you would go for. The best way to handle this, where you try to keep it with a lively democracy, is a continuous engagement with civil society. And, you know, if one of the things that I did feel good about my own tenure in India is that I had lots of friends in civil society, activists in civil society, and to keep up that conversation so that after some time there is a bit of a joint voice that some of these global unions, they begin to appreciate the activists on the grassroots activists, that you have to
You need that. You can't do without that because of the transformation in the global world. That is what you have to strive towards. Kemal, your question on the South, indeed it's fascinating what happened, and it was really unthinkable. 70s, yes, I was a student, early 70s in London. The South was a depressed mm-hmm. zone, and no one was expecting the kind of rise that that we saw. I feel actually over here, two countries played a major role, and then other countries joined in. The East Asian boom was already taking place by the 70s. Phenomenal growth in South Korea, elsewhere was taking place. But the country that was completely dormant was India. So I feel India plays a major role. China is interesting. If you look at China's growth pattern, we talk in terms of 1978-80 being the break, that China begins to grow very rapidly after that. But actually, if you study Chinese data carefully, it's not quite a dramatic break in terms of average growth. China was already growing fairly fast, even before 1978. But it was a tumultuous a rise and fall that was taking place. So if you look at the period before 1978 in China, you'll get a couple of years of 18% growth, 17% growth, sort of growth you can't imagine in most big countries. But then you'll also get another year of minus 17% growth. The economy just crashes through. The totalitarian control did help that you could take the economy through this kind of rise and fall. What changed in China after 1978, after 1980, is that you don't get these fluctuations anymore. It's a steady growth around 10% per annum. Before that, you were getting a growth of about 7% per annum in China, but that 7% was really a mean with huge mm-hmm. fluctuations. So China changes from 78-80 into a steadier growth. India's was actually, I believe, the more unexpected story. Very few people were expecting this to happen in India. There were two things which happened, and it's a bit of instruction that we have to take off our ideological hat. People put on their ideological hats and then they try to explain everything with that. India's savings rate and savings and investment picked up in the, as I mentioned, early 1970s. And that happened for a very strange reason. Indira Gandhi nationalized India's banks in 1969. With that, she passed a rule that these banks will have to open up branches in remote rural areas so that ordinary people can save money. And with this move, savings rate in India went up. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, India soon after that opened up the banking again. The nationalization was removed, private banks came in. So one fallout of Indira Gandhi's move, very mixed move, was that savings rate did go up. So whether you like that move or not, it did have that side effect. Luckily, government of India was sensible enough after that to open up that sector, so that played a role. Then something else happened in 1991. The big reforms, pro-market reforms, opened up India's economy, and by then one thing had happened. Overeducated and underemployed Indians was a pool that was waiting to be picked up. So people had come out of these IITs with unemployment. In those days, IITs were associated with unemployed, overeducated, unemployed youngsters. Silicon Valley takes off. And with the takeoff in Silicon Valley, India has a ready catchment of people who could be tapped into. And by mid-1994, India is growing at 7% per annum. This was just unthinkable. Mm-hmm. So when India joins the bandwagon of growth by 1994, slight slowdown in 1997, and again a massive pickup in 2003, and soon after that it goes into a 9% growth trajectory, the southern landscape is really beginning to change. And the big countries, China first coming in, India, before that the East Asian countries, changed the landscape in a way where I don't think it was really predictable. So what you saw in the 70s, what I saw in the 70s, I think I was with you viewing a very a similar view of the world, which turned out bleak view of the world, which changed.
Yeah. Well, I think on behalf of ISAC, I suspect, and on behalf of them, I'd like to say a kocaman teşekkürler, a grand thank you. And on behalf of us here, an even grander thank you. I think you have left us with lots of questions and comments to ponder on. And I suspect that Sabancı, they will await for you for something greater than just a passing meal at the campus. Would you agree with me,
Certainly.
Rectorum? Okay. Thank you. I think we're done.
Thank you very much.